Okay. So the Communist International was set up in 1919 with the aim of leading a working class revolution that would overthrow capitalist class rule on a global scale. But the revolutionary movement and the Comintern failed in this task. And this failure, which brought with it the rise of fascism in Germany, Italy and Spain, Stalinism in Russia, and a new world war that cost something in the order of 50 million lives, was, I think, the most catastrophic defeat of the working class in history. And so because of this, I think it's not unreasonable to ask then whether the Comintern was fundamentally misconceived, a world historic mistake. And I want to argue today that it wasn't a mistake, that for all the errors that were made, the basic approach and the core strategic orientation of the Comintern in its first 4 years were essentially correct. The failure of the revolutionary movement was not the fault of the Comintern, but was due to political weaknesses of the socialist movement outside of Russia, and particularly in Western Europe. So in the course of trying to defend the Comintern, I want to deal with a number of arguments, starting briefly with those of the right-wing sections of the labour movement who rejected the Russian Revolution, but then focusing on some of the points raised by people who professed to support the October insurrection, but raised either general objections to the Comintern or more specific criticisms about the way it operated, how and when it was set up, and so on. Okay, so the reformist socialist argument against the Comintern is most clearly put, I think, by Julius Bronthal, a long-time social democrat who was the secretary of the revived Second International after World War II. And in the second volume of his book, The History of the International, he wrote that the establishment of the Comintern divided and crippled the forces of the working class, became a disaster for socialism and ultimately for the entire world. If the split of the Italian, German and French labour movements had only been avoided, Mussolini and Hitler might never have come to power, and mankind might have been spared the catastrophe of World War II. Okay, well, working class unity is undoubtedly desirable. But the question is, unity on what basis? The workers' movement in Germany was united before the war, and it marched united into the bloodbath in 1914. But the war broke that unity, and the socialist movement split into two great camps. But it wasn't Lenin and the Bolsheviks who created this split, but it was the chasm between the workers fighting and dying in the trenches and the reformist labour leaders who tied themselves so closely to the state machines of their respective nations. So these years and those immediately after the war revealed not only a divide in the socialist movement, but also, importantly, the fact that the pro-war social democrats were the final line of defence for capitalist rule, the last means by which an insurgent working class could be held back from revolution. And this was proven, I think, decisively only months before the first Congress of the Comintern. In November of 1918, revolution had broken out across Germany. A sailors' rebellion led in a matter of days to a general revolt in the army and then working class revolution across the country. Inspired in large part by the Russian Soviets, workers' councils were set up throughout Germany. The bourgeois state collapsed overnight, the army disintegrated, and the councils, the workers' councils, became the only source of real political power. And because of this, the power of the capitalists, along with the Kaiser, were broken. But they were saved. Capitalism was saved when the leaders of the Social Democratic Party, the SPD, conspired with the heads of industry and the old order to reconstitute capitalist rule via a national assembly, a bourgeois parliament. So the council movement in Germany was defeated. And, you know, Brunthel argued that it was the revolutionaries who, by dividing the working class, led the fascists to power. But really, I think the opposite was the case, that it was the treachery of the social democrats who saved capitalism when really no one else could. It was their actions that opened the gates to fascism and war. Okay, so, you know, having got that out of the way, I think, you know, there can be no doubt that the Comintern was correct to see that its first task was in breaking decisively with the reformist portrayers of socialism. But more importantly, What about those forces to the left of mainstream social democracy who had also broken with the reformists during the war but still maintain relations with them? So, for example, the Italian Socialist Party, the PSI, had opposed the war, had affiliated to the Comintern in 1919 when it was set up, and declared itself to be a revolutionary opponent of the Second International. But it still contained within it notorious reformists like Turati, who the main leaders of the PSI were reluctant to break from. Or take the German Independent Socialists, the USPD, who'd broken with the SPD during the war. This party included both prominent opponents of the Bolsheviks, like Karl Kautsky, but also many genuinely revolutionary workers and some among the leaders as well. Both of these parties, and you know there were others like it, the CFIO in France and others, commanded a much greater following than the outright communists, who didn't even have separate organisations in most places. The most militant, class-conscious, socialist sections of the working class, without whom a revolution in Europe was impossible, these workers were members or supporters of the USPD, the PSI and others. So the approach of the Bolshevik leaders in the Comintern was to, by splits if necessary, try and separate out the mass of revolutionary workers and the genuinely socialist leaders from both the openly reformist parties, but also from the untrustworthy leaders in the centrist organisations who talked about revolution, but in practice hadn't broken with reformism. And this was the aim of the famous 21 conditions of membership to the Comintern, which its critics put as one of the central errors of the Third International under Lenin. The US socialist Lou Project, who runs the Marx Mail internet list, is one of these critics. He says he supports the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia in 1917, but he rejects most of the strategic approach of the Comintern. And one of his criticisms is that the Bolsheviks were far too rigid in their approach to the centrists, unnecessarily alienating genuine socialists and driving them back into the arms of the reformists. So he says that the 21 conditions could only be considered a slap in the face by the French and German socialists, who in every other way were sympathetic to the revolution. And he wrote of the USPD conference where the party split over the question of affiliation to the Comintern. He said that the USPD leader, Hilferding, who was on the right wing of the party, Project says of him that he argued quite correctly that the 21 conditions were a schematic projection of Russian organisational norms onto other countries with different traditions. Now, I'm going to come back to the question of the Russianisation, so-called, of the Comintern. But first, I think we have to deal with the general question of whether Lenin, Trotsky and others were, in fact, too unaccommodating to the leaders of the USPD, the PSI and others. Well, let's have a look at the role that these parties had played, just briefly. In Germany, after the fall of the Kaiser, the USPD leaders, Barth, Dittmann and Huss, made up half of what was the Council of People's Commissaires, it was called, elected by the Berlin Workers and Soldiers Councils, essentially the top organ of the councils. But when the SPD moved to establish bourgeois rule, as I said, through a national assembly, the USPD leaders agreed to this. And when the SPD created the Freikorps, an army of officers set up to crush the revolutionary left, the USPD leaders, they did object, but they did nothing really to try and, you know, seriously stop this. So in spite of their revolutionary rhetoric, and they had a lot of that, the right wing amongst the USPD had played a key enabling role in the reconstitution of the bourgeois state. And really, without the left cover that they provided, the SPD would have found this task immensely more difficult, if in fact they could have carried it out at all. Turn to Italy, where the PSI was to fail a similar test the following year, in 1920. In April of that year, 500,000 workers struck in the industrial city of Turin. The strike had started as a result of all things, an opposition to the imposition of daylight saving, which the workers saw as being, you know, an example of the bourgeois state meddling with their lives. So this wasn't just about daylight saving, though. It quickly became a full-scale battle between the capitalist government and the factory councils. I mean, much more general issues. The PSI, though, in this played a quite deplorable role. They refused to give a lead and to generalise the struggle beyond Turin. And in fact, they even moved their party congress, which had been scheduled from Turin, they moved it to Milan. Because Antonio Gramsci remarked sarcastically about this, because a city in a general strike was not adapted to socialist discussions. So Gramsci drew the conclusion from this struggle that the PSI needed to be purged of its reformist wing and a genuinely revolutionary party had to be established. And his diagnosis was confirmed some months later with the occupation of the factories again in Turin. The struggle this time developed to such a point that the trade union leaders just offered to turn the whole movement over to the PSI if they were willing to take the struggle forward and lead an insurrection. But the PSI leaders, you know, offered this chance by the trade unions, refused. And the rebellion was defeated, and I'd argue this was really the first step in the rise of Mussolini to power. So in Italy, in Germany, and in several other countries, the centrist parties had proved themselves unwilling and incapable of leading the revolutionary struggle to victory. The argument of Lenin, of Gramsci and others that the mass parties needed to break with the vacillating leaders in their ranks was, I think, proven in spades. And the problem with the 21 conditions was not, as some argue, that they were too draconian, but that they were, in the end, just words. They could only be implemented on the ground if the people charged with carrying them out actually did so with genuine conviction. I think this is illustrated by the Italian example. The left PSI leader, Sarardi, was probably amongst the best of the centrists. He was a sincere supporter of the Russian Revolution, of the idea of Soviet rule, but he was unwilling to break with Turati. He excused him and others as being better than the reformists in other countries like Germany because they hadn't backed the war. The reasons they hadn't backed the war were much more to do with, you know, Italy's role in the war than anything else, but that was his argument. And on returning to Italy after the Second Comintern Congress with the 21 conditions, Sarardi did everything in his power to water them down and demand what he called relative autonomy for national parties, which he said this autonomy must be guaranteed to them in the view of the complexity of the national affairs and national conditions, which are only understood by those who work and live within them. Now, Bronthal, the reformist I quoted earlier, remarks sarcastically about this, that in expressing these views, Sarardi had obviously fallen into a heretical error. And this was brought home to him immediately by Lenin, who had a much clearer view of things in Italy from his vantage point in the Kremlin in Moscow. Okay, the real irony, though, is that while on the one hand the Italian leaders, you know, waxed lyrical about the need for autonomy from Moscow and campaigned against a centralised approach, the justification they gave for refusing to turn the factory occupation and the strike movements into a revolutionary struggle for power was precisely the idea that the Italians couldn't act in isolation from the international movement without coordination. So Bronthal answers the question of why did the PSI leaders hesitate by saying party discussions about the prospect for revolution in Italy constantly came back to the belief that a revolution could not succeed unless it was coordinated with revolutions in other countries. Well, you know, in spite of this contradiction, the demand for autonomy was continued to be raised and is raised in reference to these arguments up to this day. And it's worth saying that autonomism, we confront it in 2010, tends to be associated with anarchists and other sort of ultra-left critics of Marxism. And it's true at the time that the ultra-left did raise demands for local autonomy in the Comintern era. But it's also the case that lefts like Ruth Fischer in Germany and Bordiga in Italy were also the greatest champions of strict centralism when they thought they agreed with the Comintern leadership. And really, the most strident defenders of autonomy did so in defence either of centrism or of open reformism, you know, an attempt to not go along with the revolutionary line being pushed from the Comintern. And Sarardi is only one example of this. In Norway, the centrists were a large force in the DNA under the banner of autonomy they took out a majority of the membership in a right-wing split in 1923. In France, Frassard used the rhetoric of autonomy to coalesce the right-wing, the recently formed Communist Party, and around opposition to the United Front approach. The right opposed the United Front because they didn't want to fight to win workers away from the reformists in the day-to-day battles of the working class. Okay, so that's a bit about autonomy, but I suppose none of this is to say that the Communist International, especially its executive committee, the ECCI, not to say that they got everything right. Far from it. They made plenty of mistakes, some of them very serious, both politically and in terms of how their decisions were carried out. And to explain this, I'm going to have to go into a bit of detail about the history. The most important of the debates played out in Germany, and because of its interconnection with the German debates in Italy as well, which is why I want to focus on those two countries. Now, the German party had got off on a bit of a bad foot at the beginning of 1919. At its founding congress, the core leaders of the old Spartacist League, essentially Rosa Luxemburg, had been unable to defeat the ultra-left wing, who opposed participation in elections for the National Assembly, on principle, the National Assembly, which was about to take place. Now, not only did this stance severely weaken the ability of the new Communist Party to influence leftward moving workers in the course of that election, but it also confirmed the fears held by the leaders of the shop stewards movement in Berlin, who'd been negotiating to join the party, that the communists were really just, you know, crazy ultra-lefts who couldn't be trusted, couldn't be treated as being politically serious. Now, the shop steward leaders were far from perfect politically themselves, but they were moving towards a more genuinely revolutionary position, and they had immense authority among core sections of the working class. And their attitude, to be blunt, to the communists was understandable. To give a sense of what the left in the party were like, in August of 1919, the Hamburg District Organisation declared that membership of the Communist Party was incompatible with membership of the traditional trade unions. So, you know, the strongest opponent of the ultra-left in the German party was Paul Levi. Now, Levi's a very interesting figure, I think, often dismissed unfairly on account of his later evolution politically to the right. And I'd strongly recommend people read this book, The German Revolution, by Pierre Breuer, which really highlights that while, you know, Levi was a flawed leader in many ways, in terms of a strategic orientation for German communism, his approach was really second to none in the few years after Luxemburg's murder. Now, Levi's battle with the left was underpinned by his orientation to the USPD. According to Breuer, Levi seems to have been the only German leader at the 4th KPD Congress to express clearly the aim of winning the workers who form the core of the USPD and the driving force of its left wing. Now, Levi determined on the need for a split in the party, which was carried through at the Heidelberg Congress, although it has to be said, was carried through in quite a bureaucratic manner and in a manner that revealed some contempt from Levi for some of the workers in the party who were influenced by the arguments of the left. Now, Lenin and Radek, who was in Germany, opposed this split, even though they agreed with Levi's political line against the left. Now, we can argue about whether or not Lenin was right to oppose the split, but even if he was wrong, it was hardly a disaster. What was worse, though, was that then Lenin went on to support the recognition of the left's new party, the KAPD, as an affiliate of the Comintern. Whereas Levi saw the main danger on the left, Lenin thought that the left needed to be in the party to balance the opportunists on the right and in the USPD. But actually, in the next two episodes in the party, the Kapp Putsch and then the March Action, it was leftist errors that led the party on a disastrous course. In the 1920 Kapp Putsch, an attempt by right-wing military officers to launch a coup against the Social Democratic government, the Communist Party initially refused to support the general strike that swept across Germany in response. Levi, who was in prison at the time, furiously denounced the party for its abstentionist approach. The leadership did correct their line, and they did, you know, avoid in doing so catastrophe, but it was a real missed opportunity to influence social democratic workers and turn the movement into a new revolutionary offensive. Well, you should probably use that word with reference to the German party. The impact of the March action, though, in 1921 wasn't to be so minor. But before we get to that, we need to turn back to the situation in Italy, which became, in the course of this, a major debate in the German organisation. Now, the Comintern executive had decided, in the wake of the betrayal by the Socialist Party leaders of the September 1920 movement, that a split had to be forced in Italy and a genuinely revolutionary party established. And in general, this argument was correct. But the way that it was carried out was disastrous. And the Italian Communist Party that emerged from it was weak. And to make things worse, it was controlled by the ultra-left Bordiga, whose whole political approach of basically, you know, kill the centrists, was, you know, guaranteed the further isolation of the party. Now, in the lead-up to the Livorno conference where the split happened, Levi thought that the split was inevitable and necessary, but he wanted everything to be done to try and push the line of cleavage as far to the right as possible in order to retain in the international and the new party the majority of workers who were influenced by Sarardi, and to try and ensure that the Italian section did not fall under the exclusive control of the ultra-lefts. The Zentrale, the Central Committee of the KPD, agreed with this argument, as did Radek. But after Levi left Germany to attend the conference, a dictate arrived in Berlin from the Comintern executive, calling for the most determined struggle to be waged against Sarardi. And faced with this, Radek flipped over and changed his position. The Comintern representatives at the Congress were the Hungarian Matyas Rákosi and the Bulgarian Christo Kabachiev. And they'd been instructed to get the 21 conditions applied without delay, and especially the clause in the 21 conditions about excluding the reformists. Now, both of these men were politically irresponsible apparatchiks who, I have to say, their ham-fisted, belligerent intervention in the Italian Congress all but guaranteed that most of those in the centre would side with the right, which they did. And, you know, whether or not they were instructed to do so, they clearly saw Sarardi, not the reformist Turati, as the main enemy that had to be defeated. And it's reflected in all the crazy speeches that they made at the Congress. So in the wake of the split that happened, the debate about Italy flooded back into the German party. With encouragement from Radek, the Zentrale backed the Comintern executive and the new Communist Party leaders in Italy. And in response, Levi and several others, including Clara Zetkin, resigned from the central leadership, which we have to say was both a stupid and an irresponsible move. So with the left now in control of the German party, this is what really had set the stage for the disastrous March action. And the Comintern played a quite abysmal role in this. And in particular, its representative sent to Germany, the Hungarian Béla Kun. Now, Kun had, to put it mildly, a checkered history in the revolutionary movement. His accommodation to the right in 1919 was partly responsible for the collapse of the Hungarian Council Republic, of which he was then the leader. But since this rightist position, he turned into a vitriolic leftist. And he was well known for his, you know, factional, sort of underhanded methods of behaving, and was held in low regard by many, including Lenin. So on arriving in Germany in February of 1921, Kuhn immediately began polemicising for a revolutionary offensive. And this found fertile ground among the new German leadership. So egged on by Kuhn, the party responded to a provocation by the government in central Germany by attempting to launch an all-out revolutionary offensive. Communists were directed to make an uprising, regardless of the resonance it had among the mass of workers. The slogan, familiar some of us in recent years, was, if you're not with us, you're against us. And communist workers engaged in physical confrontations with others who wouldn't go out on strike. The unemployed members of the party were sent in to occupy factories where the workers wouldn't go out. And the party even went so far as to blow up its own offices and blame the government in an attempt to spark, you know, the workers into revolt. And it was a total disaster, predictably. The party was routed. Thousands of its members were jailed and lost their jobs. The party press was suppressed, and as a result of all this, the KPD lost over 200,000 members in a few weeks, And as well as that, its links with non-communist workers were, if not totally broken, at least severely damaged. Now, Paul Levi wrote a scathing attack on the March action, in which he described it as the greatest Bakunist putsch in history. And he attacked not only the German leaders, but also the Comintern executive. Because while it was clear to Levi that Bela Kun had probably acted well outside his mandate from the Comintern executive, he wrote with justification that the method of sending abroad irresponsible people whose behaviour one can later, according to requirements, avow or disavow, is indeed a very convenient one. But even though it is hallowed by a long tradition in the party, it is catastrophic for the Third International. And, you know, the fact is that whatever the failing of the so-called emissaries, central Comintern leaders, Zinoviev, Radek and Bukharin, had all played a part in encouraging the disastrous Italian split and the madness of the March action. Now, the situation was made worse, again, by events at the Third Congress of the Comintern in June that year. Levi had been expelled from the party in the wake of his pamphlet attacking the March action, and the Comintern Congress confirmed that expulsion. Worse, though, was that while Lenin and Trotsky basically agreed with Levi's political line, their concern to keep the German party from imploding led them to agree to a fudge in their assessment of the March action, condemning ultra-left adventurism and advocating the need for a United Front strategy on the one hand, but on the other, absolving the German leadership and the Comintern executive from blame for the disaster. And Zinoviev in particular, who was 2 years later to lead the Comintern down the road towards Stalinism with his strategy of Bolshevization, he called it, of the communist parties. Zinoviev survived this, you know, political episode with his credibility intact, which it didn't deserve to be. So these events that I've just described are the basis for a number of general critiques of the way the Comintern operated, some of which generalise out to opposition to the whole project of the International. One of the arguments is that an international leadership, distant from events, is incapable of understanding the dynamic in each individual country, and because of that, it's bound to make serious errors. Now, it's true. You know, you can't deny that such difficulties and possibilities exist, and much more so in 1920 than today, when, you know, the extremely limited means of communication available led inevitably to delays and to miscommunications, misunderstandings, and so on. And it's for this reason that an effective central leadership needs strong and reliable local leadership on the ground that can both argue back when directives from the centre are obviously wrong or misinformed, and which can provide an accurate picture of the actual situation. And this is true, you know, even when you're talking about local sections or of a national organisation, but it's even more the case with an international organisation. But having said that, it's also vital to see that the problems in the individual parties that came up were not primarily a result of the intervention of the Comintern. The ultra-left in Germany played a destructive role from the very first Congress of the German Communist Party, before the Comintern even existed. Their errors in the Kapp Putsch were also nothing at all to do with the Comintern, which backed Levi, but actually, the problems there were a result of the political failings of the German party. And it's the same in Italy. The errors of the PSI, both in April and in September of 1920, happened in spite of the views of the Comintern. The leaders of the Italian party, Cerati, who wanted to accommodate to the reformists, Bordiga, who opposed the councils from an ultra-left standpoint, Gramsci, who was correct on many of the political arguments, but he wouldn't fight for leadership of the party. All these things reflected weaknesses in Italian socialism, not in the International. The Comintern's errors came about in the course of trying to rectify these problems. It didn't cause them. And in fact, on many points, the Comintern had played a crucial part in establishing, both practically and as well on a theoretical level, a strategic approach to building revolutionary organisations around the world. It established the need to fight for clearly revolutionary organisations, to turn these organisations not into self-absorbed sects, but parties that would actually fight to win over the mass of workers in the course of common struggle. And a whole range of issues, from the national question to the trade unions, the question of state power to the approach to parliamentary elections. In all of these things, the Comintern played an enormously positive role and had an enormously positive impact on the new communist parties. That said, there's no doubting the problems pointed to by the critics of an international dominated by a single party, in this case the Bolsheviks, whose political authority so clearly outweighed that of all the other parties. So this was a genuine issue. And one of the biggest problems was that the Russian Revolution itself, in the first years of the Comintern, the Russian Revolution itself was in extreme peril, fighting a civil war against the White Army. Now, eventually, the degeneration of the Russian Revolution was to flow into Comintern policy. Stalin, transformed it into a tool of Russian foreign policy. I'm not going to go into that today. But even before then, the difficulties in Russia meant that the key Bolshevik leaders, Lenin and Trotsky, really, were absorbed in trying to keep the Soviet state alive. And so responsibility for international policy in a day-to-day sense was often left to lesser leaders like Zinoviev and Bukharin, whose history in the Russian movement should hardly have inspired all that much confidence. Similarly, the fact that the emissaries of the Comintern executive were often less than adequate reflected the weaknesses not just in Russia, but of the international movement, that there was not the basis for a real international leadership. The Comintern was politically starved of resources, lacking in authoritative leaders, and its policies, and particularly their implementation, suffered as a result. Now, Lenin and Trotsky were well aware of these problems. Their great hope was that the revolutionary movement, as it developed, so too would the shift, the centre of gravity, rather, in the international shift. But the authority of the Russians rested on their status as the only party that had carried out a successful revolution. And so really, it was only revolution in a second country, led by a new mass organisation with its own leadership, that could really turn the situation around. But in the meantime, well, what was the alternative? To refuse to try and generalise the lessons from the Russian Revolution internationally, or to refuse to try and learn from and take leadership from a revolutionary movement that had succeeded when in every other country the revolutionary movement had not yet been able to overthrow capitalism. That was the alternative, to just abdicate altogether responsibility. Okay, Rosa Luxemburg was one of those who had resisted the founding of the Comintern, not because she disagreed with the need for a new international, she'd been won to that, but because she thought it premature without the prior establishment of mass parties in a number of other countries. And this fear that the Comintern could hinder rather than develop the development of new parties is echoed by Project when he says that the Germans would have been better off if the Comintern had simply left Levi alone, he says. But to see that without the Comintern, actually, the German organisation could never have turned itself into a genuinely mass party. It's true that Levi, along with the Comintern leaders, had the correct view on what to do, that a fusion with the left wing of the USPD was essential if they were to establish a real mass party. But actually, if this had just been left to the Germans, even with Levi's correct position, it simply would not have happened. The fusion that did take place after the Second Congress in 1920, the Second Congress of the Comintern, was driven by the USPD left's respect for the Russian Revolution and their desire to be a part of the Third International. It wasn't anything to do with their view of the tiny and often ultra-left KPD. So Breuer said of the fusion between the KPD and the USPD, he writes, "The existence and the activity of the Communist International itself were a decisive factor in this development. In the final analysis, the mass of independent workers and their left-wing leaders moved not towards the Spartacists, but more simply towards Moscow, as both supporters and critics were saying at the time." And as Clara Zetkin put it, people made up their minds for or against Moscow. Another aspect of the argument about the problems of Russian dominance is that the vast differences in objective conditions between Russia and the advanced Western countries meant that a Russian-led Comintern would inevitably make mistakes. And it's true. You couldn't simply graft the methods employed by the Bolsheviks onto the struggles in Western Europe that, in many cases, had a quite different dynamic. For example, the Russian bourgeoisie had been much weaker than their counterparts in the West. The Western working class had surrendered their arms at the end of the war, whereas the Russian workers were able to fight for power gun in hand. And in the developed countries, and probably the most important, illusions about the ability of capitalism to overcome its crises were much greater amongst workers. But while for the first 2 years, the Comintern clearly did underestimate how difficult overthrowing capitalism in the West would be, they were far from oblivious to the problems. Indeed, Radek commented that the road of the Bolsheviks had been strewn with roses compared to that of the German communists. And it is true that some of the tactics needed for communists in the West, like the United Front, were assisted by direct experience in the Western countries. For example, Radek said that the open letter strategy conceived by him and Levi in Germany, 1920, an open letter calling for cooperation with the reformist parties. And this is really one of the first instances of the United Front tactic. Well, Radek said that this wouldn't have occurred to him if he'd been in Russia at the time, that it was the experience of dealing with social democracy in Germany that posed this as a possibility. But on the other hand, the experience of the Russian Revolution, in particular the Kornilov coup, had really prefigured the method of the United Front that was to be developed throughout the Western parties in the following years. And really, on all the key problems that confronted the revolution in the West, were problems that weren't the same as what had confronted the Russians, things like the attitude to the trade unions, parliamentarianism, how to deal with the hold of reformism and the mass reformist parties, actually, the policies developed by the Bolshevik leaders of the Comintern played a crucial role in correctly orienting the communists across Europe. And, the fact that they had faced different conditions in Russia didn't prevent them from being able to do this. Okay, so as I've sort of gone over to conclude, there's no doubt that the concerns of Luxembourg about the difficulties of an international with only one established party, with an authoritative leadership, that these concerns weren't without basis. And, similarly, in defending the Comintern, I wouldn't want to argue that the Comintern didn't make many serious mistakes. Clearly they did. But the problems of the international revolution, or the problems of the international rather, were, when it boils down to it, problems with the weakness of the revolutionary movement in Germany, in Italy, France and elsewhere. The key problem and the reason that capitalism survived the turmoil of the post-war years was that there were not mass communist parties with leaderships up to the task of leading revolutions in Western Europe. Comintern attempted to overcome this problem. In the final analysis, it failed. But did this make the situation worse? Well, I think we can say definitively that it did not. Under Stalin, it's true that Comintern was to play a counter-revolutionary role. But the rise of Stalin, and of Hitler for that matter, is bound up in the failure of the revolutionary movement in the post-war years, particularly the years between 1918 and 1923. And in those years, the Comintern helped build mass parties that posed the greatest threat to capitalist rule in its history. Its general orientation exerted a clearly revolutionary influence on socialists around the world. The German party, for all its faults, and you can spend a lot of time talking about the faults of the German party, but for all of those, it became, in a very short period of time, a mass organisation. And in 1923, which I haven't had time to talk about today, it came closer than any other party in history of actually overthrowing capitalism in an advanced Western country. And I suppose the other side to it is, well, while the parties of the Comintern later did succumb to Stalinism, actually those who stayed outside of the international didn't really fare any better at all. The most important of these, the anarcho-syndicalist CNT in Spain, not only failed to lead the revolutionary movement to Spain in Spain to victory in 1936, actually it ended up playing a key role alongside the Stalinists, ironically, in destroying that revolution and allowing Franco to come to power. So in the future, I think clearly we'll need a new international. Exactly how and when that comes about is impossible to say with any certainty. But one of the key lessons from the Comintern era is though we need an international, we just as much need strong, rooted socialist organisations in each country if we're actually to win next time. And I'll just finish by pointing out that actually a lot of the people on the left internationally today who raise criticisms of the Comintern, who complain about its leadership and so on, that these same people are hostile to the project of building genuinely revolutionary organisations in the West. And I think in each country, in building organisations that can precisely overcome some of the problems that the Comintern faced. And I'll finish up there.